our podcast this week, we're in the good place, the Matthew Good Place, as he and Teresa Palmer come in to talk about Skies, A Discovery of Witches. All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast has been listening overtime to Eminem's Funum. James, you were meant to come in there.
Oh, sorry, with my Funum.
Funum. And it's awful. Awful.
We went to
awful,
a screening
awful.
Last night at 7777.
Yes, we did indeed.
It sounds like Terrence from Iron Man 3.
It's so bad.
So we heard this for the first time in the office yesterday. Just to put it on.
I'd heard it before.
I hadn't. And the rest of the day was spent just finding words that we could crowbar into this and just repeating them ad nauseum.
Yeah. My favourite bit is.
Not a lot rhymes with venom.
No, it doesn't.
as Eminem pan out to his concert.
Yes.
My favourite bit is when he somehow manages to get the word symbiote in the middle of a verse stands out like a sore thumb. It's not a smooth.
Sore thumb.
There we go.
It's appalling, and I'm sure not in any way indicative of the quality of the movie, which we haven't seen. I should point that out. We have not seen Venom.
Venom.
Will we see it next week?
I'm not going, but sure.
Are you not going to go?
No, I can't make it.
I'm going to be away.
You're going to be away?
I'm going to be away. I'm devastated. I'm going to the Zurich Film Festival.
Ben, let's have a mandate.
Yeah, you and I will be like a host and a symbiote. Along for the ride.
Yes, one of us will affix themselves to the other. Yeah. And anyway, let's move
Actually,
on.
Actually, I can't go anymore. I will not be attending this.
Like a turd blowing in the wind.
Hello, Pod. Yes. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Anarchy has already taken hold. This week, as ever, I'm joined by, well, not as ever, because there's been times when we haven't been joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. But today, we are joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning, as you have already heard. You've heard them all. We have James Dyer. I'm giving you a big introduction for once.
Hello. Yeah. Hello.
My big introduction was just saying your name, but yeah, that's fine.
Frankly, I'll take it. It's an improvement over the last 10 or so podcasts. So.
Yeah,
thanks.
It's very well.
I feel special.
Well, my eyes are lighted on you first. Yeah, that was anyway. How are you? Good.
I am fine, thank you.
You've just been telling us that if you were to ever write a memoir, that it would be called
Shit Show at the Fuck Factory. Which is the only good thing I took away from watching Succession, the TV show, because it is the name of one of the episodes. But I was very taken with it.
Oh, you don't like Succession, the television
show? I don't.
I'm
the only one who doesn't like it. Apparently, it's a really good show, except I hated it. Because everyone in it is a world-class, epic-level bellend. And I just
reminded you of The Office.
It just reminded me too much of coming to work, frankly. I mean, it just wasn't dissimilar. Okay. I just hated everyone in it. Like, really properly hated them. And therefore, could not get on with it. So I watched 5 hours of it, you know, just to touch, tip my toe in the water.
Yeah.
And then decided I would rather not. I'm in the minority, though. Everyone else likes it. We talked about it on the Pilot TV podcast this week as well.
Yeah, I'm cutting it a bit.
And I for some reason it just doesn't work. But then I didn't like Mad Men either for a similar reason, because I hated everyone in that too. Also, it's really boring and all they do is smoke and drink whiskey and it's just fucking tedious. But you know, they dress well.
Well, glad I asked. Speaking of world class bellends, it's a man with the softest hands in showbiz, Travis Fickle himself. Benny Boy Travis, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm startled at the amount of nicknames that are rolling up here.
You may have more nicknames per square inch than anyone else in the universe.
Yeah, it seems to be accumulating with every week. So,
yeah. Travelator.
Yeah. There we go, there's another one. I always really wanted to go on the Travelator from the end of Gladiators.
Yes. Is that the one that Russell Crowe does at the very end, where he's battling
yeah.
Phoenix?
Yeah, when he shouts, "Are you not entertained?" And then he runs up the Travelator.
Yeah. Gladiator's ready! Anyway, it's good to know that you're here. And alive, which is great. You've made it through another week.
Despite your assassins.
Yes.
I maintain my rule on not having dead people on the podcast. Sorry, but them's the breaks.
I don't know.
No dead, no undead, only alive people.
I'm bringing in an Ouija board. I can't see you, Helen. There's a massive speaker in the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's not James
decision.
Who means either. He's literally a speaker.
No, genuinely. I'm going to move so I can see all three of you. And last but not least, you've already heard her, although not at as much length as James. It is, of course, our geek queen, Helen O'Hara, a Hamilton superfan who most recently found herself in the same room as Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yes, I did.
Tell people about this.
I had a very on-brand weekend the other weekend, and I went to see Heather's the Musical. Mm. And it turned out to be the opening, or the official opening night. So it was premiere. So Lin-Manuel Miranda was there, photographed there. I don't know if he stayed for the show. I'm assuming he did.
Was he involved in the show or just a fan?
No, he was just a fan. Okay. Yeah. And then the following night, I went to see the final night of Spamilton, which was the
Final night.
Yeah, it was closed night, I'm afraid. It was the Hamilton kind of spoof by the writers of Forbidden Broadway. But really, it was a spoof on the whole of Broadway and not just Hamilton music. So it was wonderful.
Wow.
So yes, extremely on brand. And I now have, thanks to Spamilton, a $10 bill with Lin-Manuel Miranda's face on it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I believe that's legal tender.
I believe it is. I believe it's worth more than $10 also. So that's exciting. So yeah, it was good. And then last night I saw Kylie, which was weird, but, you know, exciting. Yeah. Yeah.
What, like in Nando's or?
No, like in concert.
Ah.
Yeah.
Did she sing, like, all her hits?
Yes. Okay. Yes, she did. But she also sang lots of stuff from the new album, which
nobody wants that.
Did she apologise for that? Because it's not good.
No, you just don't want that, do you? When you're going to see, when you see an artist, is the album out?
Yes, it's been out for like a year, I believe.
Okay,
like months and months.
So people wouldn't have had people time have to connect had, with
yeah,
the songs.
People did seem to be pleased about them.
Okay.
I didn't know them. Some of them were very nice, though.
Mm. That's nice.
It was a bit country, but I quite like
that's
a bit of country.
Very
sometimes.
Rude, Helen. She's lovely.
C-O-U-N-T, James.
Oh, I see. That's exciting. Well done. Yeah. Did she play Some Kind of Bliss, the song that she that was written for her by the Manic Street Preachers?
No, she did not. She did sing a little tiny bit of was it Wild Rose, the one she did with Nick Cave? Mm. So that was kind of fun. And she did the Locomotion.
Of course she did.
Yeah.
Did you do the Locomotion?
I don't really know the Locomotion.
Well,
moves.
I mean, you just grab the person next to you and form a human
centipede. Not in this current climate, you don't. No, we don't do that sort of thing.
No,
though,
no human centipedes at concerts.
No, or indeed anywhere.
I would. Yeah, absolutely.
Generally frowned upon.
Really?
That's another rule, along with the no undead people in the booth.
No human centipedes on the podcast. Yeah.
Helen put her foot down about that very early on in the. And frankly, it was difficult to record a podcast as a human centipede.
Oh,
the
mic sound, logistics.
The sound quality was muffled. It's really only the person at the front gets to talk. Anywho, hey, Helen, I've just been thinking, you've got that $10 Lin-Manuel Miranda thing.
I do.
If you have another 99 of those, you'll have a Hamilton.
I mean, you can keep dancing, but we're not going to be impressed.
I mean, it's radio.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Should we have a question?
Oh, let's.
45 minutes into this podcast.
Did you pre-warn us of the question?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay.
And the email I sent around.
Then
every
this
Monday.
Will be a surprise for me because I didn't read it. Carry on.
How did you know to come here then?
I mean,
you must have read it.
I probably did the classic thing that one does when reading things, where you read the first sentence, glean the important information, and then tune out and do something else.
Are you like the zombies in Dawn of the Dead, that you gravitate here at a certain time on a certain day because that's the time we tend to record?
I thought you were going to say they have short attention spans and never get past the first paragraph.
Mm. No, zombies.
Well, at least
read.
You opened the email. You never used to open emails.
This is true. This is true. We have. Well. Okay. This is awkward. The question is from @Tully_Oz, AUS. And yes, a quick glance at their Twitter bio confirms that they are indeed from Sydney. So hence the Oz, Tully from Australia. Well done. Dear Empire Podcast team, with more Harry Potter universe coming along soon, we'll be talking about that later on. That's me, not him. Which films and characters from the original series are your favourites? I'd love to hear a mini-spoiler special on your thoughts on the 8 films. Wreck off, you dag, is what he says. That's really rude at the end.
It's a hate crime is what that is.
So, so strange.
And I don't mean what he said.
Oh, you mean me?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, I thought it
was...
Dear
Australia, on behalf of the Empire Podcast, we would like to apologise.
That was a top-class Australian accent, as in it took in all of Australia. Yeah. And surrounding countries. And by surrounding countries, I mean the world.
It was a lot like having Brian Brown here among us.
Brian Brown, who is, I believe, the Prime Minister of Australia.
He is, yes, that's right. That's actually true. And Paul Hogan is the president.
That would be amazing.
They don't have a president.
Yes, they do, and it's President
Paul. He was in Crocodile Hogan. Dundee, Helen. Don't be disrespectful.
I'm sorry.
He made a speech this week, President Paul Hogan, to the United Nations, and he went, my administration is... achieved more than almost all administrations put together. And people were laughing. It was a lot of fun.
They were laughing with him. He's been very clear on that, Chris.
He went, that's not administration. wet in administration. Because he... Anyway, so the question comes from Tully. With more Harry Potter universe coming along soon, which films and characters from the original series are your favourites? And when I sent round this email at the beginning of the week, James gave it the most cursory read, glance over. Helen, I don't think you read it.
I did read it. I didn't reply to that bit.
Is it true that you print off all my emails about the podcast and wallpaper your flat with them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's very, very true.
So Helen was very excited about that. And Ben here, the Travelodge, he was so excited about this because Ben, it's fair to say, you're probably the biggest Harry Potter fan.
He's the one who looks most like Harry Potter
question,
in the room.
Question, point of order. What do you call Potter fans? Are you potheads? What's the thing?
I think it's Potterites, isn't
it? Is it?
Is it?
Isn't it?
Potterites?
How do you not know?
That doesn't sound right.
I don't think there is. Because it's an entire generation. They don't have a name.
I think
because
you just call us millennials, yeah. Yeah. To be honest.
Children.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I mean, if you grew up in the 90s as a small white boy with round glasses, it was impossible not to be into Harry Potter.
You are
a
dyed-in-the-wool Hufflepuff.
Held down every morning and a red lightning bolt was chalked on his forehead.
Although, do you know what, actually, I've got a picture of me. When I was in year six at school, at primary school, we had like a Harry Potter day. I dressed up as Dumbledore. I've got a picture of me as a 10-year-old with a big, like, fake beard on and a big robe.
Wow.
My mate, Jack Gelsup, who I don't know if he listens to this, but if he is, he was Ron. He had a jumper with a big R on it. It was a glorious day.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is 3 years ago.
Yeah, 3 whole years ago. I remember it like it was yesterday.
I was in Florida the other week, and I walked past someone at Universal Studios wearing a T-shirt that said, Gryffindor on the streets, Slytherin in the streets.
Oh, no.
And I went home and had a shower.
That's the right response.
Yes, it was disgusting.
When I was at Universal Hollywood last year, it was 40 degrees. It was, like, crazy hot. There was, a wildfire in California because it was so hot. And still, in the Hogsmeade bit of the theme park, there was somebody in an entire school uniform, like shirt, tie, jumper, robe. I was there just in a T-shirt, like absolutely drenched.
Maybe
person,
they were insulated from the heat, though.
Maybe they knew some kind of magic, because whatever.
It must be. Yeah, a lot of the performance there are quite layered.
So if Ben's a Hufflepuff, you're 100% Slytherin. Like, you couldn't be Slytherin. No, you're like, you could not be more Slytherin. Like,
the sorting
ridiculous.
Hat barely touches his head and it screams.
I think you've besmirched my good name.
No, I don't think I have.
Really?
And I think, actually, Chris would be in there with you, if I'm honest.
What?
Yeah, I think so.
See, you think you're a Gryffindor, but you're a Ravenclaw.
No, I know I'm a Ravenclaw.
Okay.
Hang on a second here.
Yeah.
Show you're working out. Him, yes.
What?
Slytherin all day long and twice on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
Slytherin, by the way, also, I imagine, describes James's lovemaking technique. But
Oh, God.
And that's why you're in Slytherin.
Yeah, to be fair.
No. QED, Your Honor, QED.
Hufflepuff describes my lovemaking technique. So I think that's where I should be.
I don't want to know what Ravenclaw does.
No comment.
Wow, we've just ruined Harry Potter for a whole generation.
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah. Anyway, show you working out. Why am I in Slytherin?
Slytherin are the strivers, the ambitious ones. It's you.
How am I ambitious?
Well,
my career has atrophied over the last 17 years. I've seen almost everybody I've worked with at Empire go on to bigger and better things, and I've just sat in a rut. You know, I get to do a podcast. That's kind of fun.
Yeah, you get to do exciting things. You, like, host things and go and do things and talk to people. And
yeah, I suppose. But that doesn't make me a Slytherin. That makes me...
You can be a Hufflepuff if you want.
I love the Harry Potter books. And I've seen Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and I loved it. But I have a complicated relationship with the films. So I'm kind of falling out of my Harry Potter fandom a little bit. Remind me again of the characteristics of a Hufflepuff.
A bit Tim, nice but dim.
Yeah, that's absolutely me.
Yeah, they're kind. I think that's the one word. Like, they're just...
Yeah.
Their symbol is the badger. That pretty much sums them up, I like. Actually, badgers are vicious little fuckers. You want to be careful.
There is a great post once I saw on... somewhere, probably Pinterest, going, which is the founders of Hogwarts talking, and they go, right, so we're agreed. There are four different basic types of children. Smart, brave, evil, and duffers. And that's kind of the houses.
All right, okay, so you're smart.
Thanks.
James is evil. I think we're all agreed.
I think we're all agreed.
That leaves Brave and Duffers, Ben.
I mean, I'm going to go Duffers. Like, I have a deep and abiding love for the rules, and as a Gryffindor, you can't follow the rules. So I think I'm just Hufflepuff by default, I'd say.
And that makes me Brave.
Does yes, it though?
There we go. I mean, we are the founders of the Empire Podcast Wizarding School.
Yeah, this is true. All right.
Anyway, so
to the question. Which films and characters from the original series are your favourites?
Okay, so film-wise, obviously, Prisoner of Azkaban, or actually, and this might be controversial, I really like Order of the Phoenix. I do not like it as a book. I think it's a rubbish book by the standards of the series.
Yes.
But I think it's one of the best films. I really, really enjoyed it.
I think it's a great book. There's loads of characterization in it, but I think the film, you feel that there's much less cut out of it because so much of the book is kind of what's happening with Harry internally, that in terms of pure plot, it can whip through. It's one of the shortest films. It's like just over 2 hours, which by Harry Potter standards is relatively lean, that it can kind of cut through that storyline without having to excise that much stuff. You don't feel some of the films, as much as I love them, feel quite choppy and they jump from bit to bit because they just have to get through the stuff they need to get through. Whereas I think you feel that quite a lot less with Order of the Phoenix.
Order of the Phoenix I read in a caravan in Devon, and it's the first book in which I felt my life was more exciting than Harry's. It is essentially a metaphor for the cost of London real estate and how you can't actually fit a terraced house onto a road. And yeah, as Helen says, it's very dull. But the film is a lot better. The film is a lot better.
Oh, also, Order of the Phoenix has the best wizard duel in the entire series. The Dumbledore versus Voldemort in the Ministry of Magic at the end is incredible, and it, like, visually is so different to all the other duels in the series. It's quite a lot more visually kind of interesting. You've got that moment where Dumbledore conjures all the water out of the fountain and is holding Voldemort in the big thing of water, and it's great.
And it doesn't mess up Bellatrix Lestrange, which I think the final film does. One of my big bugbears with the final film is that it loses the Mrs. Weasley Bellatrix fight. It doesn't give that the impact it deserves, because that should be just punching the air good, and it really wasn't. So I really like five, but honestly, like, Prisoner of Azkaban is actually probably the best of the series.
That's interesting.
Although I would say I really, really like Prisoner of Azkaban, and it rightly gets its due. For me, there's a few like stylistic moments in it that have aged quite badly. There's a few, like, really, I'm not a big fan of the night bus sequence, and there's a really really weird final shot where Harry's just got his firebolt broom and he's like is this like big triumphant moment where he's flying it over the lake, and then it ends on like a really blurry screenshot of his face kind of going kind of as he's like
freeze frame
a freeze frame, but it's not like a still freeze frame. There's like weird like motion around it. It looks like he's kind of stretching out of the frame, and it's such a weird note to end on. It's a very, very strange final shot. Then you get good credits where it's like the Marauder's map with the sneaky sex feet in there. You seen the sneaky sex feet?
I'm sorry, the sneaky sex feet.
So obviously the way they visualise the Marauder's map, in the film they show the footsteps of the people. And somebody, I believe again on Reddit, found a bit where in the corner of a room, so that, the credits, the end credits are like the Marauder's map, and there's a pair of feet kind of standing slightly outwards, and then a pair of feet standing the opposite way in the middle of them.
I see, sex
feet. So somebody's having sneaky Hogwarts sex.
That sort of thing doesn't happen at Hogwarts.
Wow.
I mean, we didn't say it was a student.
Unless, of course, you're in the room of requirement.
Requiring a big old bed.
Oh, yeah. Jimbo?
Oh, God. Do you know what? It's very hard for me to say. I've read all the books once, and I've seen all the films once, and it all kind of blurs together a little bit. I remember enjoying Azkaban a lot more than I enjoyed the first two. So I'm going to go with that film-wise. In terms of character, who do I like? I mean, Arpatz was rubbish, wasn't he? I can't really pick him.
He's barely in it.
I'll tell you who I like, though, is Cedric Diggory's dad. He's only got one scene, but he sells that entire character. He's wonderful.
It's horrible scream.
I've decided.
Oh, God.
It's Lucius Malfoy.
Of course it is.
Because he's awesome.
He is awesome.
Yeah. I love Lucius Malfoy.
I mean, that's the wrong answer, though, isn't it? Like, let's be honest, character-wise. Like, it's one of the teachers.
Mad-Eye Moody.
Mad-Eye Moody is
technically not himself for pretty much all of Goblet of Fire, but that character...
He's fantastic.
He's Snape, so great. Snape. Always Snape.
The way that Snape says, turn to page 394 alone, and I'm not kidding, genuinely makes him the best character in the franchise.
Students and Hufflepuffs, students and Hufflepuffs.
Potter.
Mr. Potter.
Mr. Potter.
Give me... my Persian bottles.
So weird that James protested vehemently being placed in Slytherin. The two characters he chooses are Lucius Malfoy and Severus Snape, so yeah. that's interesting. Character-wise, no one's gone for any of the big three.
No.
That's interesting.
I think they all need each other. I think alone, they're great as a combination, because you've got Harry is the tortured hero, you've got Hermione who's smart and brings the heart and brings them all together, Ron brings the laughs, but individually, I don't know.
No, Hermione is objectively the best of the three.
Yeah, Hermione is definitely the best.
Without a shadow of a doubt. Because she's the only one with even a shred of competence.
She has a lot of competence.
She has, yeah. She's extremely competent. The other two are fuckwits.
There's also... my sister owns a T-shirt, which is one of my favourite T-shirts in the world, and it says, Neville would have done it in four books. So I'd like to put in a word for Neville. Neville would have done it in four
books. The ultimate glow-up, Neville, across the entire film series.
Maybe it was Neville who was on the sex feed. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Neville. I wouldn't put it past him.
Really long bottom.
Dark horse, that one.
No.
Don't know what that means. What about Lupin? You're a wizard, Harry.
Oh, yeah, Lupin's great.
Well, I love it when you're a wizard, Harry.
Anybody whose reaction to somebody like having basically a sort of traumatic fit and fainting and then just giving them chocolate, I relate to
that. Yeah.
You know how he became a werewolf, don't you? A terrible experiment.
Well, also, his name is Remus Lupin, which basically means wolf.
Yeah.
Similarly,
that's nominative determinism, isn't it?
Sirius Black means black dog, or dog black.
Yeah.
He turns into a black dog. I mean, come on, people.
Yeah, not one for subtlety.
Mm. Yeah, okay. But exciting stuff. I have a controversial viewpoint in this one. Mm-hmm. I think there are only two good Harry Potter films, and those are 3 and 4. Prisoner of Azkaban and Goblet of Fire. I think the first two, Chris Columbus gets a lot of praise for setting up the world and setting up the the characters.
Especially from the other Harry Potter directors, actually.
Yeah, but they're dreadful films.
See, I kind of feel the opposite, because I feel the first two are genuinely, generally quite maligned. That people say, oh, they're just like...
That's because they're bad films.
No, I think they're really charming. They're really
they're not
charming.
There's a lot of charm in them, but they are plodding.
Also, and much as they have improved... The three leads are not great in those first films.
Yeah, they're 11.
That's what I'm saying.
That's the way to talk about Alan Rickman, Maggie Smith, and Richard Harris.
You know, it took Alan a while to get into his groove. So.
They're less self-conscious at that age, though. There's some of the later films, 6, Half-Blood Prince. When they're a bit older in their teenagers, they start to get more self-conscious about what their performances are, whereas as the kids, they just kind of say the lines with... nice smiles on their faces. But as you were saying, Goblet of Fire is the most exciting one because it's just built around these massive set pieces. You've got, like, the structure of it is these three huge set pieces. And then the, like, big changing point of the entire series, the graveyard sequence where Voldemort comes back, is really good.
It's phenomenal, yeah.
Yeah, I think... But 3 and 4 for me are the ones where those kids actually start... acting. Alfonso Cuarón is a brilliant director, and he brings a lot of flair and heart to that one. Got them out of their uniforms. Mm. That was good. Mike Newell handled 4, I thought, admirably.
He's the only one of the directors who I think went to public school, or certainly at that point he was the only one. And I think it kind of shows he gets the school element more than maybe anybody else had.
Having been to Hogwarts.
Essentially. Yeah. Mm.
But then for me, and I know Helen loved Order of the Phoenix, for me, that's where it fell apart. I am not a fan of David Yates as a director, and I feel that the last 4 movies are a bit of a plotting mishmash, to be honest. I mean, don't really get close to capturing. And this is one of the things I think that the Potter movies generally lack, is a real sense of magic.
I mean, I think that's the thing that David Yates does, whether you like that or not. One of the things that I like about his films is that, starting with Order of the Phoenix, that's the moment. The first 4 films are it's magic and it's Hogwarts and it's Harry, who's grown up in the Muggle world, then going to this other magical place. And then from Order of the Phoenix, David Yates kind of brings a sense of the real world back in. You've got that shot of Harry and the Order flying across the Thames against the Houses of Parliament. And he does that in each of his films. You've got at the start of Half-Blood Prince, the Death Eater attack on the Millennium Bridge. And then obviously pretty much all of Deathly Hallows Part 1, where it's them kind of out in the real world, away from the shelter of Hogwarts. I think he does a good job of taking what we've seen, the magical side of the world, and then kind of mashing it up side by side with the real world. Mm-hmm. But they do feel less magical and more dour and dark, and visually very dark as well, actually. I had to turn the contrast up on my TV.
Murky is the word I watched them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But hey, listen, I'm probably having people yelling at the podcast app right now, and I stand alone. I'm an island in this room. So Helen's going number 3.
Yeah.
Not counting five. Three, Ben.
Probably five, but I think one and two and seven are underrated.
You duffer. Get in the...
That's why I'm a duffer.
Yeah, that's why you're here. Jimbo?
Three.
Okay, and three as well. Three has it, and then character, I mean, I know we've all said people, we haven't really discussed Dumbledore, but it's got to be Dobby, hasn't it? It's got to be. It's got to be Dobby.
No, it absolutely doesn't.
Dobby's Jar Jar so Binks. Overrated.
See.
The franchise.
Hedwig's death is so much sadder than Dobby's in Deathly Hallows Part 1, and it gets none of the attention, and I'm very aggrieved about this to this day. Hedwig's death is so sad.
We also haven't talked about Hagrid. Hagrid's great.
Oh, Hagrid's great.
Everyone
rubbish.
Quotes Dobby, but ultimately, creature said nothing.
Again, this is why you're a Slytherin. You're like the horrible house elf that insults everyone.
I mean...
There has never been a better description of James. I'm so happy.
The horrible house elf. Fucking give you a sock. Jesus Christ.
On that bombshell, if you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast and treat it with the respect it deserves, just as Tully at underscore Oz did, much to his cost, I think... President Hogan is probably declaring war on us even now. Send in your questions. We're on Twitter as at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're also on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us also. We're podcast at empireonline.com. Should we dive straight into the movie news?
We should probably start with the cavalcade of trailers.
Is it the Henry Cavalcade of trailers?
Indeed.
Every single one of them?
We did, by the way, miss out Mary Poppins Returns last week, so we should give that a quick mention.
Everybody was not happy about that. I don't know who it was.
People have complained to me and questioned my Lin-Manuel Miranda fangirlness.
I thought you were just trying to avoid his terrible accent discussion of it.
I have chosen
Kidding.
To believe...
All right, Mary Poppins!
I have chosen to believe that any terribleness that may be in his accent, which I do not admit, is merely an homage... to the original terrible accent.
Yes, that we are living. Mary Poppins takes place in a terrible accent-filled world.
Indeed.
Yes.
Okay. Apparently, according to Twitter, Bette Midler has seen Mary Poppins Returns and said that Lin-Manuel was very good. And who are we to disagree with Bette Midler?
Who would disagree with Bette Midler?
Yes, check out Bette's in-depth test screen review on Reddit. Imagine if she was
a bit spoilery.
Imagine if she was the one who was emailing Indical News all those times. Bette Midler just goes all these test screenings. I thought the trailer looked fine. I still have worries about Rob Marshall. I like Chicago the movie, but everything else he's done since worries me. And there's a real classical... The way that the first Mary Poppins is directed is very classically directed. You know, lots of lockdown cameras, lots of wide shots, lots of masters. And I feel that Rob Marshall is a director who wants to be seen. You know what I mean? And that worries me a little bit.
A little bit. But I think what the trailer did show was that they were very much trying to get... They were trying to reassure you, I think, with that trailer. They were trying desperately, actually, with that trailer to reassure you that they could be trusted with the original, essentially. They were trying to very much emphasise how alike the original it is. And so I hope that there will be a bit more to come in showing any differences.
Yeah. And also, we got a glimpse of one of the new songs.
Mm-hmm.
from the film. And again, that is a tough act to follow because Mary Poppins is just... It's banger after... It's like going to Kylie. It's banger after banger. Jolly Holiday, Let's Go Fly a Kite, the one with the long name. I mean, there's just a spoonful of sugar. There's so many. It's amazing.
It is, but that's one area where I'm weirdly not worried. I think they've got it.
Is Linny Manny involved with the soundtrack? Or
no,
he's not?
It's Mark Shyman and his writing partner, whose name I've forgotten. I apologise. But they are good.
Yeah.
And also, I think if they had any worries about the songs at all, they probably would have said to the composer on set, "Hey, want to take a look at this?" And they clearly didn't have to.
Yeah.
So I have reason to believe that the songs will be fine.
Plot does look like it's Christopher Robin Part 2 with so the kids. What are they called? The kids.
The three kids.
Michael and
There's Michael and Jane are the original kids.
Yeah. So what are their surnames? The Bankses, yes. So the Banks kids have grown up, and Michael in particular, played by Ben Whishaw, and his magnificent moustache, has fallen out of love with what drove him in his childhood, and then Mary Poppins comes along to sort everything out again.
Yes, but with the addition of grief to the family, because
he's lost
his wife.
Oh, that's crazy.
Is he a banker now?
Yes.
He started selling subprime mortgages to people. That's his thing.
Well, in the 1930s, I don't think that was a major issue.
You say that, Helen.
I do.
It's secretly a prequel to The Big Short.
That's right.
I'm all over it. It sounds good. Yeah, we hold out hope, absolutely.
Indeed. I like the animated bits. Yes. For some reason, stupidly hadn't thought about the fact that they might do more charming old-school animation stuff, but I was really pleased to see that in the trailer.
Mm. Yes. Yes, indeed. So that's Mary Poppins returned out of the way. Jimbo, you seem relatively unmoved by the whole thing.
I mean, I didn't watch it because I don't care.
Excellent.
Great.
Let's move on to... Sooner or later, we'll find something you do care about.
Speaking of which...
Oh, God.
well, not really, because you're not in it. But so Fantastic Beasts, The uh-huh. Crimes of Grindelwald. Mm-hmm. Not, in fact, speaking of subprime mortgages, The Crimes of Gringotts, which I think would be a far more interesting film. Little goblins flogging subprime mortgages to muggles. But, yeah, so we saw this, which was... I don't know, it made me a little hopeful that this will be more interesting than the last one, which is damning with faint praise, but nevertheless.
I always felt like the last one did so much world building that like anything that followed it had a very good chance of being more interesting, and I stand by that. I think we get a lot more sense of the story this time in this trailer. It obviously gives away one of the big things that people have been speculating wildly about. The big things that people were speculating wildly about, which was the identity of Claudia Kim's character, who we now know to be Nagini.
Yeah, and that kicked off a whole shitstorm on the internet.
Well, no, because the people have been saying that for literally months, so it was not unexpected.
Yeah.
What, the shitstorm or the revelation?
The revelation. So what we knew about her was she was a maledictor. She was doomed to eventually transform permanently into a beast. So it's not like an animagus. It's not in her control. She will eventually become stuck in this animal form and completely become a beast. And they were being extremely cagey about the name of her character. And she was wearing an outfit from the first set of pictures we've seen, which seemed redolent of snakeskin. So everybody was like, I mean, duh. She's obviously...
I didn't make that connection. I haven't been on those corners of the internet. So when that popped up in the trailer, I was like, oh!
Well, yes.
Okay.
So does Nagini get killed in the Deathly Hallows?
Yes.
Yeah, Neville chops her head off.
So legitimately, you could go up to her and say, snake, I thought you were dead.
Legitimately, yes. If you were a time traveler.
Okay.
I'd just like to break for a moment and say that one year at the BAFTAs, Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn came to the BAFTAs, and James and Chris were working the red carpet and trying to do all the interviews.
This is true.
And Kurt Russell got past you, didn't he?
Yeah,
so you literally chased down the carpet, shouting, snake, I thought you were dead.
Yeah, it's actually a thing that happened. And he glanced at me, he gave me a withering glare, and then carried on moving. I can't blame him, really.
No. Remember the time Alan Rickman came to the Empire Awards and the awards had finished and we were...
He was in the buffet line helping himself to salad.
We were in the buffet. It was near the end and it was a very empty buffet room and you and I were just in there decompressing after a pretty busy night. And he came in and he was just kind of mooching around the buffet and neither of us had the nerve to go up to him.
Yeah.
Instead, what we did was we just sat there and quoted Hans Gruber lines under our breath.
Ladies and gentlemen, where are the croutons?
You're asking for miracles, dear, I give you the salad bar. You know, it was a bit like that.
I like to think that, you know, on the edge of hearing, he heard us and just chose to ignore us.
More morons. No.
Extraordinary.
Where were we?
Fantastic Beasts. Yes. So this I thought was a more promising trailer than the last one.
I didn't see this one because I have very little interest in this film. What's the deppage in this, and was the internet still angry about it?
I mean, the internet is absolutely still angry about it and will remain still angry about it. It was a terrible, terrible casting decision to stick with him.
Someone, what if he gives the best performance anyone's ever given in the history of motion pictures?
Seems unlikely.
That would be a surprise. Let's see. But he'll be doing well to do it under that makeup, I think.
Yeah.
If I'm honest, but at the same time, you know, he gets the sort of big scary speech, and that was fine, and he escapes, and that was fine.
I think the escape sequence looks like it's going to be a real goodie. We see a few extra shots in this trailer from that sequence.
Yeah.
That makes it look very exciting.
My bigger takeaway from this trailer was I don't understand the plot, because it seems to me that Dumbledore has recruited Newt Scamander to be his magical assassin.
That's correct.
A man so patently unqualified, given that he's an absolute fucking idiot, and they have professional auras to do this shit. However, J.K. Rowling has since addressed this point on Twitter and said, I could tell you the answer, but it would give away the whole story.
I think the reason for that is that the wizarding world is not necessarily perfect, and the wizarding world is rather divided on Grindelwald, and certainly the American wizarding world seems to be well screwed up So, like, they have a complete ban on any contact with muggles. So there's no intermarriage, there's no fraternisation, there's no nothing. And I think the idea is that the London Aurors are similarly compromised to some degree. And when you see that scene of Gellert, you know, addressing what appears to be a large room...
Gellert, is it?
Yeah, well, okay. You know, we're mates, we're not mates. Mm. I think there's an element of people are interested in what he has to say. It's the Malfoys, James. You should be interested.
I do love a Malfoy.
Well, it's that kind of person, isn't it?
So. Did I tell you the story? My Malfoy story. That I was in LA at a hotel with a bunch of people, and we'd been at the Harry Potter Park thing doing the writer stuff, and we had been at a
sex party.
No, and we were coming down in the lift. My friend Kevin was doing his impression of Parcel Tongue, and he was doing it in the lift. And the doors opened, and I shit you not, fucking Tom Felton walked in the middle of it. And there's this point where, and he walks into the lift, and we lose our fucking minds, go bright red, and just stare at each other, just like thrumming with, "Oh my fucking god, has this happened?" And he must have wondered what on earth he walked into, as we all go completely silent and freak out.
That's amazing.
But yeah, so Parcel Tongue, do it now. He might come in.
Who's the most famous person you've ever been in the lift with?
Ozzy Osbourne.
Like random. Liam Neeson once randomly at the Dorchester.
How did you fit in?
I was in there first, so it was really, you know.
Did he have the tripod with him?
But I was at the time, I was trying to like pull on a boot or retie a boot, so I was hopping around on one leg and the door suddenly opens and there's Liam Neeson. That was...
Did he help you with the boot? Because I presume that's on his particular set of skills.
It is.
I'll help you with your boot. That's amazing. Good. Liam Neeson, solid. Ben?
I don't think I've ever been in a lift with a famous person, but I walked past Paul McCartney as I was entering the Soho Hotel and my mind exploded. And I went into some tech press briefing thing and just didn't concentrate for the entire half hour because I was like, it was Paul.
Did it give you wings?
He did. Yeah.
How did you? That's a music reference from James.
It was surprising, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a silence.
Yeah, that was all right. I was in a lift once with Tony Bennett at the Four Seasons in LA, and he said goodnight to me as he left, which was very classy. What a classy guy!
What a guy!
He knew he was in the presence of greatness, and so he wanted to acknowledge it in some way. He was freaking out the entire time.
Remarks like that are why I think you're a Slytherin. just to be clear,
he was like, "Fucking hell, is that guy from that podcast no one listens to that hasn't even happened yet?" In the same lift, I had dreadful small talk with Colin Firth. One time, that was not good.
Were you playing the bumbly Colin Firth part in that conversation?
I think I was, and he was playing the assured,
smooth Colin Firth
who
part.
Was being harangued by a moron. But the best, this did not happen to me, and I cannot remember the person it happened to, but I heard the story from someone who's on the American film writer, who said that he was in a lift once, probably at the Four Seasons in LA, that's where everything happens, and he got into the lift, and Larry David got in the lift, and it was just him and Larry David. And as the lift went up the floors, this guy, and I'm really sorry I can't remember his name, said to Larry David, "I'm thinking of writing a book on awkward celebrity encounters in lifts," or elevators, because he's American. And Larry David says nothing. And as the elevator begins to ascend, Larry David suddenly turns and pushes him against a wall. The lift doors open. He walks out and goes, "Put that in your book." And off he goes. That's like the best thing that's ever happened.
That's superb.
Yeah, I like it. So Harry Potter then.
Yes.
Wow, this is a tight 45, isn't it? This one.
Wait, let's move on to the next trailer.
Which is?
Bumblebee.
Oh my god.
Is that the next trailer? Okay.
Yes. Dark Phoenix can come later. I'm saying Bumblebee, and I'm gonna go to the mattresses for this one. Like that trailer. I mean I've been quietly hopeful about Bumblebee for a while, and I've said it I think a couple of times that even though, you know, the I believe I've described them as twisted metal orgies of Michael Bay's films are just dreadful. This I thought could be good because Travis Knight's a good filmmaker and actually a new perspective. Basically anyone in the world who isn't Michael Bay could do something fun with it. And seeing this trailer, this is everything I ever wanted from a Transformers movie. It's the 1980s. All the Transformers, and there are more than one Transformer, it's not just Bumblebee, look like the Transformers I had as a kid. You know, they're the first generation ones. You see original Starscream, Soundwave, Shockwave, Ravage, Wheeljack, all these kind of cool characters. And yeah, I geeked out like massively, and then spoke to Travis Knight about it, and he reinforced all this. Like, he's, you know, a similar age to me, I think. And again, that's what he loves about Transformers, was all these 80s toys, and that's what this film will be, and I think it will be joyous.
I mean, it looks like you might actually be able to tell them apart this time, and that's not just like a glib remark, but the designs of those classic cartoon and toys, they're all different colours and different designs, yes, and you'll and actually shapes. Be able to see rather than just like random shards of metal hooked together.
Because they look, by necessity, they look like the thing they transform into, because those are the limitations of actual toys. Mm. Whereas Michael Bay's ones, as you say, it's bits of spiky metal and stupid shapes. That they have no real sense of differentiation.
That is, I mean, that's true of sort of especially all the bad guys.
Although one of them did have swinging testicles, so I suppose that's
that was terrible. But in fairness to the design of those, I think they actually genuinely tried to work out what would be involved and made that.
Yeah. That didn't go so well.
I just want to defend ILM a little bit.
It's because you've got mates in the effects industry.
No, but also, I genuinely think the transformations are the best thing about those films. The effects are by far the best thing about those films.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I like the first Transformers, I did.
After that, they're just terrible endurance,
and I can't be dealing with it. But this looks like it has a certain joie de vivre.
Well, the thing that the first one has is that, like, that opening hour before all the mad, smashy, crashy robot stuff comes in is the sort of teenage boy in his first car, character stuff, and it looks like they're really dialing into that here. Yeah. Hayley Steinfeld's super charming. She looks really... That shot in the trailer where Bumblebee's trying to ruffle all of the sand out of her hair, and she's like, no, stop it, that's enough.
Yeah.
It's cute, it's really fun.
It's going to be great, I really do. And triple changes, there were triple changes, which is exciting. Justin Theroux and Angela Bassett play triple changes. I can't remember the actual names of their Decepticons off the top of my head.
Pretend for a second that the rest of us aren't as super fucking nerdy as you are. What's a triple
changer?
Are
you pretending you didn't have Blitzwing and Astro Train back
in
the ages?
I had very few Transformers toys growing up. I had Mirage, the F1 car. Mm. That may be it.
Okay, well, you were
I had to go out to my friend's house and play with them. All I had were the My Little Ponies.
Well, I was quite spoiled, so I had a number of them.
You had all of everything.
And triple changes.
And again, we go back to the Slytherin.
Father, get me an Astro Train.
From that commoner, Father.
Take it from him, take it.
Throw him some money, Father.
It's a triple changer.
So the triple changes, as the name implies, change from three things: two vehicles and a robot. So Astro Train was her space shuttle, a train, and a robot. But the ones in this, one's a helicopter, a car, and a robot, and the other one is a plane, a car, and a robot.
A plane is not the same size as a car. It makes no sense.
A gigantic car.
It's just a really big car.
Come on, people. I feel like I'm digging crazy pills.
Yeah. But anyway, so Bumblebee, you know, I mean, it's out on Boxing Day, and who honestly the fuck goes to the cinema on Boxing Day? But still...
Lots of people.
I don't understand that. I've never in my life got up on Boxing Day and thought, must go to the cinema.
I'm usually in a turkey coma at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah, but where better to do that than at the cinema?
Like,
yeah.
I can't get past the front room on Boxing Day.
How bad must the cinema smell on Boxing Day? You just open the door and turkey fart just waft out of you. It's like, oh,
hint of gravy.
Yeah. Anyway, Bumblebee, well done, everyone. Thumbs up. Good job. The final trailer we're going to be talking about in this bite-sized news section is X-Men Dark Phoenix, which hit the internet today.
I didn't hate this as much as I thought I might after Apocalypse. Nothing in it really set my world aflame. But
ironically,
yes. But I'm interested to see it. I like these characters, although, and we were talking about this a bit before, I am a little bit bored of Magneto and Professor X just monologuing at each other because it's so tedious.
And something that Magneto literally acknowledges in the trailer. I think this should not actually be a Professor X and Magneto story. And the problem is that the way they've set this up, it kind of has to be. The problem is actually ultimately casting. And it's an embarrassment of riches that is the problem.
Yes.
They didn't know Jennifer Lawrence was going to become the biggest star in the world, so they've got Mystique in completely the wrong role in these films, which has become a major problem in Apocalypse, and I imagine it might be a problem here. And similarly, if you've got James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender, you've got to find something for them to do. But then the Phoenix story, instead of being a story about a woman, becomes a story about two dudes. Again, I just... This whole thing that, it's all Professor X's fault because of blah, blah, blocks in her memory and everything, that's an X3, The Last Stand notion. And we don't need that.
This is where it gets interesting, of course, because this film is written and directed by Simon Kinberg, who's long been a producer on the X-Men movies since starting with First Class, but he co-wrote X-Men The Last Stand. Both Ben and I have interviewed Kinberg recently. Mm-hmm. Ben did it for a trailer breakdown, which is up on the website.
Now, by the time the podcast
is out? By the time you listen to this, it'll be up on the website, so you can go and check that out. I interviewed him recently for the magazine. It'll be out in a couple of weeks' time. And he has spoken. In fact, he said this on our Days of Future Past spoiler special, that he essentially, and I'm paraphrasing wildly, fucked up The Last Stand, and he loves the Dark Phoenix story, and he wants to, he would love the chance to tell it again. So he is. And what interested me about this trailer is that it seems to be hitting many of the same beats as The Last Stand. In fact, you could even call it a quasi-remake. It doesn't have Wolverine in it. Yeah. It doesn't have, you talk about, you know, characters being out of proportion. It doesn't have Storm, because Halle Berry was a huge star and had to take a lot of the story weight of The Last Stand as well. It doesn't have that Cure subplot. Mm. Kimberg has assured me that Sophie Turner, Jean Grey, is the main character in this story, that she gets, she has more lines than anyone else, more screen time than anyone else, gets more emotional heavy lifting to do than anyone else, and hers is the main story. But at the same time, there's Charles suppressing her powers as a child, which happens in The Last Stand, yeah. And there seems to be, there's shots of a funeral, which happens in The Last Stand. We don't know who the identity of the dead character. Yeah, it's interesting to me.
I mean, I guess one of the main points of difference here, other than Wolverine not being around for this one, is that Kimberg was quite clear with me that it's going more cosmic. So the origins of the Phoenix and how Jean kind of becomes the Phoenix is linked to a mission where they're out in space. And that he also told me that Jessica Chastain's character, who we don't know the exact mm-hmm. identity of, she's not a mutant. She is an alien. She's mm-hmm. an extraterrestrial being. So I guess it's interesting that this is the first time the X-Men films have really gone out there kind of space-wise. Yeah. And I wonder if they feel, obviously, now that they can do that, because of some of the groundwork that the MCU has done in taking what we think of as Earthbound superheroes, but then also placing them in a wider, more cosmic universe, that the X-Men films are kind of going there now for what is potentially maybe the last kind of Fox X-Men film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels that way.
I do appreciate the cosmic angle. I think that's probably a good thing, but it still seems to be a Professor X cause things. It was a bit weird. I'm not sure how. I mean, obviously, we'll see how that's going to fit together. I do think that they could. This trailer, I mean, I applaud it for emphasizing character, which I think is, you know, something that a lot of superhero movies obviously don't do, especially in a first trailer. But at the same time, I think we needed one shot of something really big. I think they could have rushed like an effect shot to show us something that gives us an idea of the Phoenix's real scale, because it feels like she's throwing police cars around. I mean, so what? You know, the last dude leveled Cairo. Mm. There needed to be maybe just something a bit bigger.
So the last shot we see in the trailer is Jean, and she's kind of phoenixing out a bit. She's got these kind of white lines on her face. And I asked Kimberg, is that her approaching kind of maximum Phoenix? And he was like, no, that is like two or three on the Phoenix scale that they're really going to push it out there. So I'm intrigued to see what that is. But I think he was quite clear as well. I kept referring to it as a trailer and he kept referring to it as a teaser.
It's a teaser, yeah.
It's the first. Yeah, I guess there'll be quite a bit more to come.
Do we know anything about the chain of events of how it all... I suppose what I'm asking is, what is the Order of the Phoenix?
Oh, God.
Slytherin.
You've been sitting in silence there for 5 minutes. Trying to come up with that, haven't you? Trying to make that work.
No, but it wouldn't be out of character.
Speaking of which,
he saw the opportunity.
I'm disappointed that Fassbender isn't going full first class in this, because I want him to be like, "Oi, Magneto," and like properly, you know,
call me Magneto.
Jesus Christ, look at that! She's turned into a giant bird. And
can I just point out, we're going to be dealing with an Irish revenge movie later in the podcast, so y'all should pretty much have some respect, because you know, some guy might come along and.
Is that a threat?
Hanging out
a window. Is that a threat?
Yeah. Mm. Was, yeah.
Wow. Gryffindor no more.
Gryffindor never. Ravenclaw.
Oh, Ravenclaw. Yeah. Okay, well, 100 points to Slytherin then. But yeah, look, one other very, very quick thing about this X-Men trailer is that this film takes place in 1992. Mm. So they're doing that thing again where they're shifting the films on 9 or 10 years after the last one. So First Class was 62. Days of Future Past was 73, Apocalypse was 83, and now this is 1992. So what that means is that at some point in the continuity of these movies, and frankly, that's gone out the window a long
continuity
time ago.
Continuity is such a strong word.
It really is. When it comes to the X-Men movies, continuity is a four-letter word. And that means that Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy have 8 years to become Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart. I don't see that happening anytime soon. But it also means that some of these characters are now meant to be in their 40s and 50s. Yeah. And there's a shot of Ty Sheridan as Cyclops in this movie, and he still looks 12 years old. And I'm not entirely sure that this needed to be the thing that you needed to do for these movies. Not each movie didn't need to push on 9 or 10 years. Yeah. That wasn't the selling point.
I mean, it's one of the things that does worry me slightly about this, because, again, I asked Kimberg, obviously, even Jean and Cyclops, they were only introduced in Apocalypse, and we saw the start of something there between them. But by this time, because it's 9 years on, they're supposed to have this really fully fledged relationship together, and I really hope that they manage to do a job of convincing the audience of that and making the audience feel like they have a connection to these two as a couple as well, because he seems to think that is obviously really central to the Phoenix story.
Yeah, it should be.
It should be. And he said that it is absolutely central to the story, but whether the audience kind of goes along with that when we don't necessarily have that connection with these actors as these characters who supposedly have this relationship.
Yeah, I think that there is that risk, absolutely. The gap thing is bizarre. It was really bizarre and distracting in the last film, where you had people talking about, oh, he's got so much potential. It's like, well, he's like 34, like he should be using his potential at this point. You know, it was bizarre. Hey,
they're late bloomers.
Apparently.
Yeah. Nicholas Holt's character, who would be in his 50s now, and again, he looks like he's 12. Mm. But, you know, I'm hopeful for this one. But I do feel that this is going to be the last one. I mean, but not that Kimberg or Fox wanted to be the last one, but because last week Bob Iger, confirmed in a phone call, I think he was doing like one of those shareholder phone call type things that happens every so often, that should the I's be dotted and the T's be crossed, that's the right way around, yes it is, on the Disney-Fox takeover, then Kevin Feige will be assuming control of the X-Men movies and bringing them into the MCU.
Yeah, and that does put this film in a really odd position, because I feel like you've got a lot of slightly more casual fans, but still fans, who are like, well, I hated Apocalypse, so I don't care about this.
Yeah.
And you have the hardcore fans who are going, well, I just want to see Feige do it, I don't care about this. I think there's a real risk of this falling sort of between the cracks.
It becomes
irrelevant.
And I
hope it doesn't. I hope it is relevant, and I hope it does do the Phoenix story justice, because I really want to see that. But there is a real risk.
We'll see it again in 5 years' time, the MCU.
Well, that's it. This feels like the last of the X-verse, doesn't it, really? Yeah. I mean, New Mutants aside, this feels like this is going to be the last X-Men film we see until it's completely reimagined as part of the MCU. So,
yeah, ironically, Dark Phoenix could be the last stand of the X-Men.
Oh, boy.
That's a good segue out of this little trailer park that we created for ourselves. Any other movie news before we move on?
There are a few things we should discuss. Mostly Birds of Prey, for example, has finally got some casting. Some more casting, which is exciting. That was announced last night. Mary Elizabeth Winstead will be Huntress. Mm-hmm. And Journey Smollett-Bell will be Black Canary.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite cool casting. I haven't seen many of her things before, but she looks cool, so I'm hoping she's awesome.
Yeah.
And she beat, apparently, Gugu and Betha Raw to get the part. So
yeah, they actually make them fight, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
As far as I can tell.
So she must have something, seriously. So that's exciting. So, that's taking shape.
Happy Death Day is getting a sequel called Happy Death Day to You.
Love it.
Number two,
love
letter
it.
U, which made me smile inordinately yesterday.
I got stalked by the Happy Death Day baby when I was at the Halloween Horror Nights. It was quite terrifying.
That's not a good thing. James Wan is producing a remake of Train to Busan. The most important thing you should take away from this story is that you need to see Train to Busan if you haven't already. If it has to be remade, and let's face it, it probably does, because it's a great, great concept with fantastic zombies. Of course, Hollywood wants to get its hands on it. But if it has to be remade, I think James Wan is not the worst person. So, you know.
Just very, very quickly as well, Patrick Stewart took a picture of the writer's room for the Picard TV show, The Return of Jean-Luc Picard. James, is relevant to your interests. The writers include Kirsten Bayer, the great Michael Chabon.
I know.
Diandra Pendleton Thompson, Emmy nominee James Duff. They're all there. All looks good, tickety boo. Everyone's very, very happy and excited about this. I'm getting into that. There is one person in the room who gives me pause. Akiva Goldsman, writer of some of the worst screenplays in the history of Hollywood. Won an Oscar for one of them.
Chris not sitting on the fence there.
Yeah. And he's still involved with this, like a turkey fart that won't go away.
Wow.
Note to self, never be around Chris when he's eating turkey.
Yeah. What do you think of Liz, Jimbo?
I choose to keep my my rose-tinted tricorder on, and it's not a thing.
Visor?
I don't know the name of Geordie's visor. I was thinking,
is it just a visor?
I think it's just a visor. Anyway, I mean, it's Star Trek. It's got Jean-Luc in it. Mm. I mean, really, the work experience person could be writing it, and I would still be there to watch it the second it aired. So
I would prefer the work experience person to be writing it to Akiva Goldsman.
Oh, it's going to be glorious.
Michael Chabon's in there. Come on, people. This is really exciting.
Make it so, motherfuckers.
What he said, for once.
All right, good, good, good. And we're going to finish off with some very, very sad news, which is that the producer of Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back, Gary Kurtz, passed away this week at the age of 78. And it's very, very fair to say, I think, that without him, Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back wouldn't be the films that they are, or probably wouldn't have had the cultural impact that
Absolutely.
They did.
Absolutely. Yeah. He took so much of the marketing of that first film on himself, like going down to Comic-Con and like trying to, you know, convince fans that this would be an exciting thing. And also I read a really interesting thing on one of the reasons why the prequels never quite measured up to the originals. I mean, obviously a lot of factors, but Gary Kurtz was a moderating influence, I think, on George Lucas. He used to push back a lot at some of George's, shall we say, worse instincts. Whereas Rick McCallum, who became his producing partner afterwards, was much more of an agreeable kind of, not a yes man, but he used to let George take the reins, and he used to go along with basically whatever he suggested, and he didn't.
So
have...
a yes man.
Yes. So in fact, he was a yes man.
I think that's a definition. Helen just did it as your lawyer.
Whereas Gary very much used to push back, and I think really was instrumental in shaping Star Wars into what it is. So it's very, very sad.
He was instrumental, I think, in helping focus the idea of the Force.
Yeah. I was also just going to mention his Dark Crystal work, which he was a really, really major force in getting that made. He even shot some second unit, I believe, on that.
Yeah.
And that's a phenomenal, phenomenal film. And again, that is an unlikely thing to happen, to succeed. It is weird, it is dark, it is twisted.
It's horrifying.
And you need a really sympathetic producer to get that to happen, and I think it's wonderful that he did.
Yeah, also produced American Graffiti as well, of course, which is where he and Lucas formed that bond. And it's a shame that they fell out on Return of the Jedi. Kurtz was one of the ones who really, along with Harrison Ford, wanted Han Solo to die. Didn't happen. It didn't work out that way. They never worked together again. I don't know whether they made it up, or mended the bridges before Kurtz passed away. But it is very, very sad indeed. He was based in England, and he would often come to the Empire Awards. Did anyone meet him? Did you ever meet him at those things?
I don't think so.
I think I did a 5-minute red carpet interview with him. He was very nice.
Yeah, from everyone I know who's met him said he was a lovely, lovely guy. And his impact on pop culture is immeasurable. So Gary Kurtz, who passed away this week. Time now for this week's guests. Sky is currently showing A Discovery of Witches, which is a fantasy romance, I would say, about a witch who falls in love with a vampire.
It's happened to us all.
We've all been there. The witch is played by Teresa Palmer. The vampire is played by Matthew Good.
Is he a Matthew Goody or is he a Matthew Baddie? That's the question.
We don't know. Ben here went along to talk to them recently and had a great, with an E, time. Enjoy. Also with an E.
Really pleased to welcome to the Empire podcast Teresa Palmer and Matthew Good.
Thank you very much.
Of A Discovery of Witches. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good.
I haven't seen her in months.
I know.
You guys have just been having a nice little catch-up.
We have. It's been a while.
Yeah.
In fact, I was actually on the set of this a couple of months ago, and the last time I saw you, Teresa, you were being dropped down a well repeatedly.
Oh, that was a fun
That had nothing to do
ankle.
With the job. It was,
no.
The crew had enough.
Yeah, the Welsh people took against you shooting in Cardiff. How's everything been since then, since the well dropping
better,
incident?
Better than then. really, really good. It was beautiful shooting in Wales. We were there for 6 months. Mm. Did a bit of stunts, hanging upside down.
Yeah.
Yeah, fun.
I remember there was lots of screaming, lots of kind of hanging you up and then dropping you and
lots
then winching you back up again.
And then repeating the process.
Yeah.
A
the thing about filming, isn't it?
For 8 hours.
Yeah.
So you guys play Diana Bishop and Matthew Claremont in the series. Teresa, your character is a witch. Matthew, yours is a vampire. This is fantasy territory. Are you guys fantasy people? Are you genre people? Is that
your
a world
fancy.
That you guys
I mean,
grew
in
up
my
in?
Private life.
Your fancy.
I mean, do you know what? I mean, I suppose I was more as a kid. And then The closest I got to it recently was when my daughter started enjoying Harry Potter and I started getting a bit more into that world. But it was never really my genre. I was always more into sport than anything else. But it was a joy. I don't read many novels these days because I just...
We have too many children.
Yeah. Well, if you go on holiday, if you ever go on holiday, then I'm more like a lifeguard than I am someone who can sit there and read a book. I long for the days.
So, me too. One day.
Yeah, but when you're forced to read something, it was actually... And I really loved it. It was actually surprisingly moving. Mm-hmm. It's not... Because I think she's flipping the genre a little bit on it. Not on its head completely, but there's a lot of mythology which is changing. Mm-hmm. For example... I don't have fangs.
Yes.
Which and you're around in the daytime.
Pale.
Yes.
You are pale.
But I'm English.
You're British, sorry.
There you go. It's a joy to do something that's it makes a lot more sense when you read the book and, you know, you get into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, did you take a lot, Teresa, as well from the books? And because the books are from Diana's perspective, right? So did you get a different insight into the character from that?
Yeah. They're pretty similar in the show and the books, but definitely I found it very interesting just to get into her head a little more. Mm-hmm. Obviously she does the narration in the book. So there were a few little nuances and bits and pieces I picked up from that.
But an adaptation is going to be different. I mean, people would be like, who know the novels would be like, mm-hmm. how are they going to, because the first 120 pages, it's basically her going to the Bodleian Library and me turning up occasionally. And so it's like, so it's a fascinating read, but you kind of wonder, what's that going to be like on screen? It's a bit boring. Right. So they very cleverly adapted it making it sort of episodic and chapters and flipping things. It's been well done.
Mm-hmm. And when did you get involved in the project? How did you feel about it when it came to you, especially if you're not from the most like sort of fantasy background? Was this something that changed your mind that you were like, oh, actually, this just sounds something...
The minute someone said trilogy, I went, great. Jane Chanter, who's our producer, who's a force for good in the world, and just a force of nature, actually, brought me in for a discussion and sort of offered me the job, which was brilliant, but said, I don't want you to read the book. Just read the first couple of episodes. And I read the episodes and thought, this is really interesting and quite fascinating. And he seems like a very strong character. And someone that you can sit... You know, I think if you do all three books, it's nice to be able to sit in a character for a long time, because that's rare for us normally. I mean, now it's changing, but it used to be for a while, oh, it's a great book, let's adapt it and put it into a 2-hour movie.
That's
what's great about television now, is that you can unfurl the story like you do the chapters of a book, mm-hmm. and you can take time. So then it was all about who's going to play Diana, and it was pretty well, the only person really on the list that we wanted to do the job was Teresa. So we had to go across and have
a chemistry meeting.
Really?
Yeah, that was funny. Yes. And the casting director was like, guys, it's great that you get on really well and you're joking around, but we do actually have to film some scenes. Straight off the bat, we went chatting about life and parenting and all the things.
That's just that also England and Australia is pretty, you know...
Similar sense of humour.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Not at the beginning, obviously, we sent you onto your own island, but now it works out really
well. But now we can all laugh about it.
It's fine. Yeah, that's right.
It's a big joke.
No reparations.
Yeah.
that first time you guys met each other, that must have been... Because one thing that was really apparent coming on set was that, like, even while we were doing our, like, big interview and stuff, that you guys were just you
couldn't shut up.
I know we got into trouble sometimes. it was really great
it's kind of rare in its own way as well, because you know those things are either going to go one way or the other. It's either going to be a bit serious and crap, or you know, in a chemistry read, or it's going to be
he was a goofball, and that was great for me. And we could take the material, and even though we both really respected it, we could also poke fun at the fact that he was a vampire, I was a witch, and we were falling in love. And we just it was lighthearted, and there was a great camaraderie between us. And it was good. It felt like that with the whole cast as well. I think it was just really beautifully done, just all of the pieces of the different people and our cast and crew and the producers.
It's a great cast.
It was a wonderful family, and so it made that the 6 months of filming really enjoyable. And I think we all did our very best because we were just having such a good time together. Well, not you. Not
you're
every day.
Incredibly positive. I bring the cynical.
We're the yin and yang.
Yes.
Dark part. I'm just kidding.
It's true. You're the earth mother, and there's not been a word created for what I am. Yes.
Yeah, did your goofball side, did that tip over into sort of antics and shenanigans?
Oh. For the rest of the cast. No, it was, yeah, I guess. I mean, also, when you're doing stuff that's quite dark, you try and keep it fairly light when it's not rolling. Mm-hmm. But we did have, like, the depth of the cast was brilliant as well. And we did get some, you know, filming in Oxford is always an honour, really. Mm-hmm. It's such a beautiful place. And we didn't get to go to Venice, which was a shame.
I know.
But
yeah,
the other cast did. I hear it was as beautiful as it was left.
Yes, good.
Yeah, and, you know, we got Lindsay Duncan. Like, I was asked, who would you like to play your mother? And I thought, Lindsay Duncan would be pretty cool. And because she's with my agent. Mm-hmm. And I was like, we'll never get her. Being cynical, obviously, as I am. Yeah. And luckily it worked out. And so there were just... We had Trevor Eve and the younger cast, Ed Blimel, who I just adore. Aisha Hart.
The show as well.
Yep. And our favourite Welshman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, do you want to name him?
Nah.
No.
who's your favourite Welshman?
Well, I mean,
we love Mr. Owen.
Yeah.
Owen Teal.
Positively glowing.
You're Game of Thrones fan?
Yeah,
I am.
But I'm one of those people that I only just about keep track of all the character names, let alone like who's playing.
I actually haven't seen it. I know he's a big deal because whenever we do press with him, we get followed by hordes of Game of Thrones fans.
Gamers.
Gamers, that's actually what they are. Yes. They're the gamers. Mm-hmm. We were at Comic-Con recently and there was just like a mass of people very excited to be around him. But he's brilliant.
Is he Davos? No.
I don't know the show.
I don't know the show either. I think he's the bad guy. Does anyone else know?
I mean, there's a few. There's some real bad people in that.
It's one of the bad guys.
Well, the gamers I know we're talking about.
No.
It doesn't need to be mentioned.
Owen Teal, you'll know. Google him, you'll see his face.
Everyone listening to this now will be Googling it.
That guy.
I've seen his face and his bottom. If Game of Thrones has anything to do from what I know about it.
They're all naked.
Yeah, everyone's naked.
Not in our show. It's very PG.
They only have their clothes on when they die. And not even. Anyway, next question.
you were talking, so you missed the Venice trip, which sounds like such a shame. Yeah.
We flew to Venice and then we turned right and then we went to my castle.
Where were we again? That was a fun.
I don't know what the name of the village was. I remember buying a couple of trinkets with your cash.
I know.
My kids. I know. In the square because there's no money.
That was fun.
But it was a beautiful place.
We stayed in that spa hotel.
We had a volcanic dip.
But
every night.
What's a volcanic dip?
Well, it had a hot spring hotel.
Ooh. And it had a hot spring swimming pool. I mean, literally like being poached every evening. But it was it was very misty, and so you'd sort of come out. We finished work, and about 10 o'clock, you'd intrepidly go through the mist. And then you'd see people making out at the bottom. You're like, oh, I don't want to go down there.
Ooh, they're having a moment.
Yeah.
It's quite romantic, quite exactly. Ibiza down that end.
How's that as like a cast bonding experience to all just go in a hot spring?
Yeah, it was fine.
Yeah, you'd see the crew in there, like your first AD, and it was quite interesting.
Quite hairy, the Welsh. So, a lot of hair. God knows what the filter was like in the morning in the pool.
Everyone had a good laugh. We all hung out.
It was a long 6 months. It was a brutal winter. It was brutal.
Well, I was in Cardiff for one day.
Yeah.
And had just a small walk through the city to get a coffee. And it was beautiful, but it was so rainy
and
so cold.
Yeah.
How did you
survive? Well, it's a culture shock. I mean, you were such a trooper. That's the great thing about Teresa. You could throw her anywhere in the world. She'll get on with it. And I really mean that. Because you had your two kids and your husband was away for a lot of time.
Yeah,
you had a nanny, but the minute you finish work, you've got to finish. Like, take them home, get them down, breastfeeding, learning your lines, coming back in at 5 in the morning. You never complained.
It was brutal. Yeah, you were the great at complaining.
Source of joy.
I was, since I've finished the experience, I was like, wow, I really was like going through it. You know, I'll have more help this time round. But my kid, I totally relocated there. I brought my family there. My husband
to a house
was
that made no sense.
Working. Yeah, I ended up renting a house in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, really?
It looked really pretty in the pictures, but it was like 45 minutes away from work in the middle of nowhere. No. And we would get snowed in and I'd have to trudge to the main road to get picked up with the kids on my back. So
would you mind bringing, can you get everyone from your, like, so you want me to carry carrying my two kids whilst breastfeeding 2 miles down through the snow to the
for
car.
My 5 a.m. pickup in the
morning. Right, yes.
So you know, I didn't choose wisely.
That's what Airbnb doesn't show you.
I know exactly.
You being snowed in.
So now I know where I'm going to live for next season.
Swansea.
Right next door to where we film. And you know, my son was going to school there at a Montessori school, so I really immersed myself into the Cardiff culture, and I fell in love with it. I think because we were all together, we made the best of
Cardiff's
it,
cool,
made
man.
It a little adventure. Yeah, and we enjoy being in Cardiff.
House Hobbs will travel.
Yes, yes, I will. Yeah. Bingo lingo.
Bingo lingo.
We had a few nights of bingo lingo, ooh, which is very fun, very local
you
to
haven't
Cardiff.
Lived.
Is that like traditional bingo, or is that like sort
it's
of
like
bingo?
Bingo.
I would say
bingo
not.
And booze and a lot of music and dancing, and you'd go out with the crew and it
and the
was,
occasional gunging.
Yeah. Oh gunging. Yeah. Our
did
camera
get
operator.
Gunged?
No, our camera operator did. Mm-hmm. He had full green slime, ooh, dumped on top of him.
Utterly thrilled about that.
Yeah. Yeah, it yes. was great. I have that on video.
Especially, I guess, after that, then, when you've got to walk yeah, through Cardiff, like, in the freezing cold, covered in slimy
slime.
Green.
Yeah, lucky for him, he was the one that got picked. His apartment was across the street, so he could go and change. And then his jacket got stolen that night with his phone and wallet. It was just a bad night for him in general. But, yeah.
He's a handsome lad, though.
Yeah.
Some of the crew
I think he had a good night.
Some of the crew got to find out about that. Which is great. Yeah, let's find the positives. This is unlike you. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm really enjoying it because... So you guys filmed this at the new Bad Wolf Studios in Cardiff.
Which are huge.
Which are massive. And there's loads of big productions. In fact, they're shooting Historic Materials there now. And it
that's
means
right.
that all these... A-listers are basically coming to get the full Cardiff experience for several months while people are shooting these shows.
Yeah,
like well, Lin-Manuel Miranda, the Hamilton guy, is there at the moment. He keeps posting videos with his wife being terrified driving through country lanes.
Oh,
have you
yeah,
got any
the country
sort of
lanes.
Survival oof. Advice for yeah. people?
Don't, man, I wouldn't even drive in the country. I couldn't do it because there'll be a whole mile stretch of a tiny, teeny, tiny road. And mm-hmm. if you start heading down and a truck comes towards you, you're screwed. I don't know, survival.
Isn't that scary though?
Find all the best vegan restaurants in Cardiff. There mm-hmm. are amazing ones there. I was very impressed. I don't know. Cardiff doesn't need to be survived. Cardiff is...
No, Newport does, but Cardiff's fine.
Cardiff, we really enjoy it. I did, anyway.
Yeah.
You were sort of out of Cardiff. You weren't really in the city.
I took myself away.
To, like, a golf...
From the playground.
He wanted to golf at ooh. All times in between
that's
setups.
That's right.
So
I am that cool.
He's that cool.
But
so
also,
you were far away.
I was... Well, yeah, I was like you were...
You're further than
you
I
were
40 was.
40 minutes one direction, I was 40 minutes
in
the other.
In the other, yeah.
But I quite like that in the morning, because it gives you a bit of time to just get your head on... Like, get your lines, you know,
get
where you're going at during the day sometimes.
I always had a kid in my car, though. So
that's true.
Just, I was always
and
playing
and I left mine at home.
And, yes, you did. I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Tips for next time.
Yes.
Matthew, I've got a really dumb question to ask you that
please.
I've never had the chance to ask anyone before. So your character name in the show is also Matthew. Is that really... Is that a help or is that a hindrance? Is that like an annoying thing on set that if someone says Matthew and you like to meet
good
me,
question,
to meet the
not
character?
Dumb question.
Okay.
I mean, ultimately, on those days when you're not necessarily with it... you'll probably still turn. And mm-hmm. whereas if someone's calling you Adam, you might, you know, and you're just away with the fairies, then, you know, mm-hmm. It might not work so well. I don't really think about it that much. It was the vampire stuff that was tough,
yeah.
Not the name. But yeah.
You had that down pat.
Down pat.
It was a vampire
yeah,
from
she
day
has a,
one.
She has a very good impression. Her impression makes it like all I ever do is this.
He had the face, he had the voice. He like dropped his voice like an octave lower and he's done. That's all he has to do.
I think everyone did that though. I think that's the thing. I think everyone had the same
yeah,
interpretation.
Didn't Lindsay say that as well? Like,
yeah,
she just
like,
dropped her voice.
Obviously
lower.
I've done my homework, but really and truly it'll just look like I'm doing a low voice and being a bit slower than I would normally.
I mean, you basically,
which is
in
true.
Every sense but the literal sense, you pretty much played a vampire in Stoker in the Park Chan-wook film.
No, not
like,
really.
Oh, wait, but that, the style Super of that character, he's quiet and
stoic.
Mysterious and he's in the background.
Are you saying this? This
I
I'm just,
love
I'm
that
just
movie.
Phoning in the same performance.
No, but I could see it when I knew that I was coming on.
Creepy.
he does creepy great.
No, that was great fun, that job.
Yeah,
yeah,
I love
what's
that
it like
movie.
To work with him? Because I'm a massive fan of the movie and
I thought it was so fantastic.
Films as well. What's he like to work with?
Just the joy. And also I got it, you know, but also we're working with a translator and he's very, very quiet, very hushed. Mm-hmm. And you sort of have to get used to who do I look at when you're speaking? And you get over that fairly quickly. But I find it really soothing, the Korean language as well. So I'd be off with the, you know, off with the fairies. Mm-hmm. Very relaxing. But his ability, he looks at the smallest thing. So he's like, we're not filming today in this room. I'm changing the scenes because the walls are not yet the same colour as this egg. And you're like, wow, okay, cool. I don't know what to say, but you're cool. But he's one of the most brilliant directors I will probably ever work with. It's a shame that no one saw the film.
I did.
I know, but
it was fantastic.
Shame that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these things, they always have a life on DVD and Netflix and beyond. And Teresa, I wanted to ask you about a director you've worked with, which is Kate Shortland, who you worked on for Berlin
Summer. She did a somersault.
Yeah.
As well as that film.
Good one.
Thanks, she's kind of attached to the Marvel Black Widow film.
I could not be happier for her.
That,
I have.
Give me a part.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I was like, isn't there a sister role in that?
I've got my figure back after the babies.
Yeah. Hello? Hi, Thomas.
Hello?
She's such a brilliant filmmaker, and she's also a really good person. I think the way she sees the world is in such a different and very fascinating way. Mm-hmm. She still sees the beauty in the tiny mundane things that we kind of look over. And I think she's a perfect choice to play that role, and obviously to direct that film. I reached out to her.
Yeah. She's amazing.
Yeah, she's taking over from Scarlett. She's just, I can understand why mm-hmm. they chose her to do that. And I just reached out to her and I said, I'm so excited for you.
And did you slip in the, can I have a role? Is that a world that you're interested in?
I'm waiting for the perfect time. Mm-hmm. I thought the first congratulatory email was important. Wait a few months and then you slip in the follow it up with a PS, give me a role, mm-hmm. please. Yeah.
And Matthew, in your future, Downton Abbey film is coming back. It sounds like you're coming back for it as well.
I read this on the internet.
But in a smaller role, but have you kind of caught up with the cast?
It was always a small role. Apparently I came out the other day and said that I was going to be in it, which I shouldn't have done, so I can't say that anymore. So what I will say is that I might be in it, but it is definitely...
And it might be at the very end.
And it might be at the very end.
I read that.
Were you to be in it? Are you looking forward to catching up with everyone again? Because that last season, it must have been quite a...
It'll be a fun 3 days of filming, yeah.
And one thing that you won't be back to is The Crown, because the whole turnover in the cast.
I know, just as it gets
Emmy
good.
I know. By the way.
Oh, you're very kind. That was really fun to do, and I have no doubt. I mean, it's a big thing for them to recast every role, and because they'll do it brilliantly. The people who are doing Peter's writing, and the actors and actresses they've got are, or just actors these days. The actors that they have are sensational. So it's just whether the audience can accept it.
Have you spoken to Ben Daniels?
I know him through a friend, but I haven't. I'm not really, Good luck. What did he say? But I saw the photograph of him as with the camera the other day, and with his piercing blue eyes, and I was like, God, he looks better than I did. And he's going to go. I know there's some scenes that I spoke to Peter Morgan, just in case anyone's listening to this, and he was saying I've just written these amazing arguments. Between the two of them, I was like, "Well, I'm thrilled for the next guy." But they'll be great,
amazing.
And Ben Caron, who's directing, is superb. Mm-hmm. So it's in safe hands.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, guys. It's
thank
been lovely you. To have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Okay, that was Matthew Good and Teresa Palmer. Time now to talk about this week's big releases on the big screen. And Helen, you mentioned an Irish refrenge drama earlier on. That is Black 47.
Yeah,
take it away.
Always bet on Black.
In this case, yes, it's set during the Great Famine in 1847 in Ireland, and a young man who's been serving in the British Army, controversially, comes home to find that his mother has starved to death, his brother has been hanged for trying to steal food, and his sister-in-law and sort of nephews and nieces are on the verge of also being kicked out of their house and dying. So... he falls out with the local authorities, it's fair to say, and then goes on a quest to right things, basically. It is a bit of an Irish wish fulfillment film, this, obviously, because the English are awful. And this was an entirely man-made famine, or at least not entirely, but mostly man-made famine. Ireland was exporting food the entire length of the famine, which left a quarter of the population dead or gone forever. And so it is an incredibly traumatic background, and therefore it is incredibly satisfying to see someone kill people who did it, because that's basically what this film is. But it is essentially, if, even leaving aside the political element, this is just a really good revenge thriller.
It's like a Gaelic Walking Tall, isn't it? Like, he comes back from the army and then starts beating the living shit out of everyone, like Jack Reacher.
It's a western, essentially.
It is. It's an Irish western.
I mean, it's in Connemara, so that's west.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, quite. No, I enjoyed it. I also thought, is it James Freshville? Is it that plays Keeney? Is the lead in it? He does the most extraordinary pad bear stare of any man I've ever seen. That just flat stare.
Yeah, you do not want to mess. Yeah. He's pretty formidable.
Yeah, it's quite bleak, but then it does become, as you say, it becomes a little bit. He has a very particular set of skills, and he, you know, employs it to just take everyone down.
We should also mention, of course, some of the other people in it, because Hugo Weaving is the British soldier who's kind of the hunter tracker who's brought in to find him and stop him, which is going to be tough for both of them. It's not going to be fun. You've got Stephen Ray as the guide, sort of almost comic relief, and Freddie Fox as the most hissable Englishman in history.
Freddie Fox, who plays the embodiment of everything that's wrong with public schools.
Yeah, basically.
But also you've got, was this made a while ago? Because Barry Keoghan's in it and looks really young. Like, he looks at least 5 years younger than he did in American Animals. And I'm not sure when this was made.
I think it was made fairly recently.
Really?
I don't think he looks very different to me.
Got excellent makeup artist on that show.
Maybe.
So, despite Helen's wild praise, we gave this just 3 stars. But hey, as we always say in the Empire podcast, 3 stars is a recommendation. So go and check it out. Not a hate crime.
We exported the 4th star instead of using it.
Next up, we have Skate Kitchen. Benny Boy.
Yeah, this is the new film by Crystal Moselle, who she's previously mainly done documentary work. Her last film was The Wolf Pack. This kind of blurs the lines between documentary and fiction. So it's about a group of female skaters in New York who are called the Skate Kitchen, and in real life they are a group of skaters called the Skate Kitchen. She kind of came across the idea when she met Rochelle Vinberg and Nina Moran on a subway. They were with their skateboards, they were talking about shooting the shit together, really, and she saw them and saw potential in this idea. And so you get Rochelle Vinberg playing Camille, who is a young teen skater living outside of Manhattan. I think she's on Long Island. And she, at the start of the film, she injures herself trying to do a skate trick, and her mum kind of freaks out and takes her board away and says, you need to stop skateboarding because you're going to injure yourself. But she sees the Skate Kitchen on Instagram, and when they have like a sort of group meetup, she sneaks out of the house with her board and goes to join them. And basically it's just a lovely coming-of-age film about women and skateboarding and friendship and companionship. And then a little bit later on you get Jaden Smith coming in as a boy who kind of takes...
A skater boy.
And she doesn't say, see you later, boy. Camille kind of finds herself drawn towards him. I just thought this was... If you like coming-of-age films and
love them,
you like skateboarding, the boarding in this is, like, beautifully shot. It's amazing.
You strike me as someone who's never been on a skateboard.
I have. I grew up in the 90s.
Yeah, I know, but
I mean,
still.
I mainly, like, sat on it and rolled down a hill rather than actually standing up.
I just don't picture you gleaming the cube or anything, you know.
Gleaming the cube? Is that
you're
really
just
racist.
So young. Do you not remember Gleaming the Cube?
No.
This was a skateboarding film with Christian Slater from the 80s.
I see. Well, I'm going to track that down because this was great. I'm really looking forward to mid-90s, the Jonah Hill film, which is also kind of indie skating drama. Mm-hmm. A couple of standouts here for me. Nina Moran, who's one of the other kind of founding members of the group, she plays Kurt, and she is just like endlessly charming and hilarious in this. And Dee Dee Lovelace, who plays Janae, one of the other members of the group, she kind of gets quite a lot of the dramatic weight of this, and she carries it really well considering they're not kind of trained actors in any sense.
But no, it's really well put together.
Cool.
Cute film.
4 stars in for Skate Kitchen. And Jimbo, yes. Night School's up next, and this team's Kevin Hart with Tiffany Haddish.
I know, as do you, as both of us went down to see this to our peril last night. Yes, this is a Kevin Hart film, and that may be all you need to know. He is a high school dropout who loses his job and finds that he needs to get his GED, go back to high school, and graduate so that he can get another job. Tiffany Haddish stars as his sort of shouty teacher, and hilarity ensues. Not really, no.
Does it though?
No. This is one of those things where if you like Kevin Hart, you might enjoy him in it. I I give him a certain amount of leeway because I really, really loved him in Jumanji. So I have not enjoyed him in anything else, but I really like liked him in that.
I like him. I think he's very
He has a certain amount of charisma to him, and he uses that, I think, to carry this film to an extent. The problem is it's very, very lazy, very lazily scripted. A lot of it is improvised. You can just see the joints where they've done multiple takes and just stitched together different things they've done with it. Yes. And some of the jokes do kind of land, and some of the jokes really fantastically don't. And the story just kind of meanders around and seems slightly incidental to the performances. It's not particularly enjoyable.
Yeah, it's one of those movies where characters just disappear without warning. So Ben Schwartz, Sean Ralphio on Parks and Recreation is his best friend, and he just disappears in the story for like a good hour, and then they remember, oh yeah, we've got this really funny guy, we should use him, but not allow him to be funny. And this movie is going to be sold on the chemistry between Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish, who, of course, shot to fame with Girls Trip, which I thought was fantastic, and she was amazing in it. And that film has the same director, Malcolm D. Lee, and this is his follow-up to that. And I had relatively high hopes going into it. I remember laughing at the trailer when it came out a few months ago. I was slightly disappointed by this, to be honest. I think it is a fairly lazy film, and the chemistry between the two of them doesn't really work because their styles are really the same. I don't think that really works. They don't really mesh, but they both have funny moments. And, you know, a famous movie doctor who likes to witter on about entertainment has a rule about comedies. That if you laugh six times, it passes muster. And I laughed more than six times at this.
How did I react during this film, Chris?
You laughed twice, James. And I don't think either of those could be even classed as laughs.
It was more of a slight half smile.
Yeah, every now and again, you just gave me a signal that you were still alive. And that was fine. That's okay. At our age, it's what we have to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was a disappointment for me. We have not reviewed this yet at the time of recording, so the Empire review is not up yet. But if this is more than two stars, I would be amazed.
It's going to get a one or a two. I think
for me, it's really harsh.
Between the two, it probably scrapes a two, but it isn't great.
It does scrape a two because there are people in it who are really funny. Kevin Hart's funny from time to time. Tiffany Haddish is funny from time to time. Rob Riggle's funny from time to time. Al Madrigal, who looks a lot like
Hispanic
Zach Braff. Amazingly, is very funny as well.
I know.
So this podcast is being edited today, so I won't even know what the score is before this podcast goes up. So here we go. Let's hedge our bets, shall we? So, Night School there, and sadly, that got just one star. Night School there, and we gave that two stars. So there we go. That was Night School, and we gave that three stars, which we always say in the podcast is a recommendation.
And Night School astonishingly got five stars from Empire
Magazine.
Five
stars, and our reviewer loved it. Loved every second of it. Thought it was the best film they'd ever seen. So 5 stars, 4 stars, 3 stars, 2 stars, and 1 star land for Night School. And sadly, none of us have seen at the time of recording. I'm seeing it tonight. The Wife.
The Wife. Which...
No, please, please, no.
Please leave that in. Please leave that in.
Which is... The Wife, a glorious comedy make benefit for the people of Kazakhstan. No, it's... this is Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce, and she is the wife of a beloved writer, an esteemed writer, but he is a very cold man and he has his secrets, and she never gets the limelight and she never gets the love that she deserves, and she is the backbone of his career professionally and personally. And so it's about her finally deciding that, screw it, I'm going to, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. It's based in the book. Okay.
It's a good book, yeah.
Good, excellent. By whom?
I forget.
The writer of The Wife.
The writer of The Wife. I think it's Meg, but I forget her. Sorry.
The Meg wrote this. That's astonishing. And so this is driven by a powerhouse performance from Glenn Close. Apparently Jonathan Pryce also good. But this is one may well be in contention for an Oscar this year.
I think it says in our review that it could be her 7th Oscar nomination. She's been nominated 6 times, but never quite got it. So this could be another Oscar-worthy performance.
So you're saying she's come close?
Why do we allow him?
Wow. 4 stars in for The Wife, so check it out this week. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by a double whammy of directorial goodness. We'll be joined by Paul Greengrass, director of 22 July. That's how he pronounced it to me.
We will, or you will, have seen Venom, 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 Venom.
Surprisingly, we don't have anyone from Venom on the podcast.
The symbiote will be here.
I can't imagine why. This movie that we have pinata'd repeatedly over the last 6 to 8
what
months.
What if it's absolutely incredible?
Yeah, that's they tend to show films are incredible 6 hours before they open.
In fairness, they sometimes do.
They sometimes do, but that's usually for plot reasons. And there may be,
there may be
a
huge plot reason here.
There may be a plot. The plot was, and it turned out to be okay.
Look, exactly. That could be the great... Because we said over and over, all these good people are signing on for this film. Yes, it must have something.
What possible reason could they have? There is...
Money.
A Hamilton of cash. What have they got paid in those Lin-Manuel Miranda notes?
They only find out now. Yeah, it's too late.
Michelle Williams goes to her money cave, which I assume all famous people have in their houses. They have money caves. And she goes, right, well, now that film's out, time to spend some of my Venom dosh. And she opens up the briefcase with like the $1 million. And it's like just Lin-Manuel Miranda's face.
The golden light hits her face.
Do you think they do, like in Breaking Bad, where it's just on a pallet and they just lie back on it and do snow angels in the cash?
Yeah, it's full on indecent proposal.
Scrooge McDuck.
But that would probably work in Beverly Hills, right? You go into a boutique in Beverly Hills and you're paying $10,000 for something.
I mean, and just like a belt, probably.
Yeah, a belt. Yeah. And you just pull out the Lin-Manuel Miranda notes and they go, that would be acceptable.
There are certain parts of New York, I'm pretty sure, where that would be legal tender. Yeah.
There you go. Do you get the change for Robert Lopez currency? Is it? That was a Broadway musical
Broadway
composer's joke there.
That's
fairly inside baseball. But anyway, let's move on. We're also going to be joined on the podcast by Damien Chazelle. So that's a lot of fun, isn't it?
Yay. Will he be the first man on the podcast?
See, if I'm not allowed to do it.
But you do, so...
Again, Helen, I must deduct 100 points from Ravenclaw.
10 right. points for Slytherin.
Now we'll make it up on finals, it's fine.
That is such a Slytherin thing to do, to just award yourself points.
See, this was the whole problem with the house system in Harry Potter, that they'd lose a point here and a point there, but then at the end of the series, because they've saved Hogwarts, it'd be like 100 points to Gryffindor, hooray!
I love that Dumbledore does it for the drama as well. He puts up all the banners of the house that's supposed to have won, and then at the last minute it's like,
he's like, yoink, bait and switch! Yeah. Psych!
He was such a prick, I'm glad he's dead.
What a twat.
Yeah. Screw Dumbledore.
Oh my God, we have just lost every single listener under 35.
Not the Slytherins.
Yeah. Until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again next week, it is goodbye from James Dyer.
Goodbye.
It is goodbye from Ben...
Wishaw.
Wait, hang on, I've got it. It's goodbye from Ben Traveller's Checks Travis.
Goodbye?
He doesn't know what those are.
No, oh, yes,
doesn't.
That's right. In
like
the olden days.
Money slip?
Like it's a money
like
slip,
a money
yes.
slip.
That's right, that you keep in your fanny pack. And it's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to watch the trailer for Creed 2, which we didn't talk about.
Oh, gosh.
But we should have, because I'm really looking forward to that film. So
I must break you.
Yes. Yay for Creed 2.
Yay.
Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.